Thank you, Danny. Thank you, good friends. Thank you, good friends. Thank you, Rotarians, for what you mean and all, have always meant in the communities and in the civic life of our state. Your ethic of service and community involvement is one that has inspired imitation among many of your fellow citizens, and I hope it'll always be important. You'll always be an important fixture in the life of Indiana. Thank you for this great forum, one that I had hoped to use, have hoped to use as a way not only to speak to this important group of Hoosiers, but through you to all our fellow citizens today. And I'm just delighted at your famous hospitality and that it was extended to us yet again. Thank you, Mr. President, for remembering George Carlin. I miss George Carlin a lot. And who else asked those great questions that always bugged me, like, exactly what was the best thing before sliced toast? Or what's another good word for synonym? Carlin was a comedian, but you know, asking new questions, asking interesting questions is a pretty important trait in business or in public life. And it occurred to me that our team has spent a lot of time trying to ask questions that maybe hadn't been asked before. Why do we do it that way? Do we ever try this? Or how about this new idea? And I want to take advantage of your hospitality here today to talk about things we can do going forward to extend Indiana's positive momentum and our increasingly unique position as an island of solvency and a magnet, I hope and believe, for jobs and hope and growth and opportunity in our region and perhaps nationally. And I'm going to start by taking you on a little fiscal travelogue, a little quick tour over ground we've recently trod, Indiana's road back to solvency. Danny made mention, but after seven straight years of spending more than it took in, Indiana state government adopted a new set of approaches, and we have now racked up the third straight balanced budget with some effects that you will see very soon. Back there in 1999, when red ink first appeared on the books of the state, this state had a $2 billion surplus, a number some citizens still seem to remember and play back to me. It's interesting that they recall that after so long. We did this in a very mysterious way. You're going to be so impressed with the ingenious method that our team applied to getting out of the red and into the black. We started spending less than we took in. Is that not brilliant? I make light of this, but it was serious business, and it was not easily done. And I just cannot thank enough the great people, some of whom are your guests here today, but most of whom are back working on the public's behalf right now, for all the hard decisions, all the reforms, all the new wrinkles, all the new ideas that collectively came together to reduce a rate of spending that was running at 6% when revenue was only growing at 4% to less than 3%. Revenue's still not growing any faster than that, but this achieved the desired effect. Having balanced the budget, step two on the path to solvency was to pay back the debts. We had close to $800 million of debts, and they were not very responsible debts, in my opinion. They were borrowed covertly, without the permission of the borrowers. They were borrowed literally by stiffing schools and local governments and universities, holding back funds, state funds, that they were entitled to until the next fiscal year arrived. It's about 6 months delay. So the interest, the carrying charges for 6 months of a very large sum was borrowed interest-free by the state. That charge was imposed on schools, local governments. So over the last few years, we have taken the annual surpluses and paid all this back, and we are back to even with the schools. And then step three on the road to recovery was to restore the bank account, the savings account, once again. Once as large as I mentioned, it's $2 billion. We went negative on the balance sheet of state government. Our net worth, so to speak, was negative in 2004. We came out of that condition in 2005. And with the end of the fiscal year just closing, or the $321 million surplus, our total reserves, the rainy day funds in various forms that protect education and other important programs against downturns like the one the nation is in now, are back to about 10% of the state's budget. State budget this year is a little over $13 billion. We've got a little over $1.3 billion in reserve. Good thing, because we may well need it. And, as was mentioned, we got an interesting phone call a couple Fridays ago, one that really surprised me. State's credit rating, I think of this as the good housekeeping seal, was upgraded to AAA for the first time in state history. I'm really proud of the people who made that happen. I hope you are too. Now, all is not so well with our competition. Let's just put this in some context. In red, the 32 states of America who are in the red right now. This list has been growing. And I'm happy to show you that we are not on it. We are really almost unique in our neighborhood. I was just in West Virginia. The governor there is a friend of mine. He's in the black, but that's because he's sitting on coal extraction revenues, as are most of those white states in the South and West, oil, gas, and so forth. If you don't have that, you got to do it the old-fashioned way, as we were just talking about. And nobody's credit rating is being raised in any of these states right now, I can tell you. Now, this is not an accounting matter. This is not just of interest to the CPAs in the room or the green eye shade types. This has human impact. It matters whether you take very careful care and stewardship of the people's business. Because when states go broke, unlike the federal government, they don't have a printing press. They can't simply crank up some more money and to spend it without limit. Most operate under balanced budget requirements, and bad things happen if you allow yourself to slide into the red. Education is cut. California just pink slipped 20,000 school teachers. That's a third as many as we have in the entire state of Indiana. Health programs are being cut. Social services are being cut. There are states letting convicts out of prison early because they can't afford to keep them there. So it is much more than a matter of financial responsibility, some abstraction. Whether you look after the people's business as we have been trying to do. Now, having arrived at the position I described, we had a chance to do something else we wanted to do, the next step on the way to, I hope, the most taxpayer-friendly status in America. And that was to cut property taxes. You all will remember this, interesting saga, although it all happened in a fairly short period of time, really just about 8 or 9 months. But the short of it is that using some of the surplus that we'd accumulated, we passed a bill, which is the biggest tax cut in state history, delivers $1.72 of tax reduction for every dollar that the new penny of sales tax will bring in, and will take our property taxes in Indiana into the lowest 10 in America, with an additional protection that I'll talk about more in a minute, the caps on what any taxpayer can be expected to pay. 38% average reduction, actually, as the county's bills are being calculated now, the trend has been for tax reduction to be somewhat greater than was forecast, but averaging around 38%. Now, this walk to fiscal solvency raises, I think, interesting opportunities for our state, and I want to talk to you about a couple of them today. There are two steps that I'm recommending to our fellow citizens that I think can take us from where we are to a position truly as a national leader, as a model, as a capital of taxpayer protection. And I want to talk about those two ideas and perhaps enlist a little help from you. The first step is to finish the job on property tax reduction. The caps, which are now in statute, that say that no Hoosier will pay more than 1% on the value of his or her house, more than 2% on the value of the farm or rental property, more than 3% on any other business property. These are almost unique in America. Only a few states have them, and only one state I can find has anything that's as firm and low as this. But this job is not final. Those caps are only in statute. We've taken the first of what must be three steps to make them permanent and constitutional. The legislature has voted once to submit this to a referendum of the people. A second vote under our law must occur, and then you, the people, get a chance to vote. I'm very confident that if the people of Indiana get that chance, they're going to vote to lock in these caps and this unique in America protection. We have to make sure that that vote happens and that it comes soon. Here are the members of the Indiana General Assembly from the region in which we are meeting. I'm happy to say that the vast, vast majority voted once already to make the caps permanent, or at least to give you the right to vote for it. I'm going to be traveling Indiana these next 3 months, or 6 months, I hope, until the General Assembly gets here, urging Hoosiers to ask their legislators, please, let us vote. Cast that second vote if you did the first time. More than two-thirds, I'm so proud to say, in this bipartisan accomplishment, more than two-thirds of the members of both parties in both houses have cast this vote once. All we're asking is that they do so again. But I think every legislator or candidate or aspirant for the legislature ought to be asked, yes or no, will you let the people of Indiana vote to put these caps beyond the reach of any judge, beyond the reach of any future General Assembly, to renege, to retract, to take away? We are this close to having some of the lowest property taxes in America and a unique set of maximums protecting every Indiana taxpayer. As business people, you know that in addition to the value of low taxation, certainty itself has an advantage. Knowing for sure that a home's property taxes will never skyrocket, that a business's property taxes are limited, will be kept below some lid, some maximum, has value all on its own. It will further enhance Indiana's improving reputation as a great place to do business, and it will make us a capital of home ownership. So I am very hopeful that you as citizens, the active citizens you are to belong to this organization, will in the friendliest and most encouraging way possible visit with folks who want to be in the next General Assembly and ask them to be on the yes side of this resolution when it comes before them. And we will take that last step together as a state, and we will establish Indiana as a national model in low, permanently low property tax protection. Now a second idea. Having arrived at the position, or at least approached the position of fiscal sufficiency that I just talked about, budget balanced, all debts paid, and a healthy savings account, rainy day funds in reserve, I think allows Hoosiers for the first time in many, many years to ask themselves this question. At what point should government stop collecting money from a free people? At what point should the government recognize that these dollars belong to free men and women and should only be collected for an essential government purpose, and then should only be spent with the exquisite care that never wastes a dollar if it can be avoided? We are either at or approaching that point. of fiscal sufficiency. And so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about what system we might put in place that further protects taxpayers. Is there a trigger point at which we recognize that every dollar extracted from a taxpayer's wallet by government is a diminution of freedom by that little increment? If that dollar were left with you as a taxpayer, you could freely choose to spend it on something important to you or your family or your business. And so, as a first a matter of principle, and then a matter of practicality, I have a suggestion to make. The matter of principle is, it's your money. It's your money. It's not the government's money to concede to you when it wishes. And the practical matter is this. If government gets its hands on it, it's likely to spend it. Worse yet, to commit the spending in future years, sometimes to its regret and always to the taxpayer's regret. P.G. O'Rourke once said that giving a legislature an unlimited ability to spend money was the equivalent of handing car keys and alcohol to teenage boys, you know, something you want to be very careful about doing. Those other states, those in the red on that map I showed you a minute ago, by and large are victims to this phenomenon. A few years ago, when we were broke, they were flush. What did they do? Imagining that the good times would roll on and on, they committed to new spending programs, which now they can't afford, and they are undoing them, or worse, in the fashion that I depicted for you. And so, I suppose my summing up my view on this subject, better the money stay in your pocket than burn a hole in theirs. So here's my suggestion. An automatic taxpayer refund. A dividend, if you will, but automatic in our law that says that at the point of fiscal sufficiency, and we can debate what that is. The fiscal experts think 10%. They recommend 8 to 10% of your next budget as a protective cushion, but maybe it's more. This we can talk about. For sake of today, let's just say 10%. Anything above that, I suggest, ought to be refunded automatically to taxpayers on their next tax return. For my money, I would do this per capita. This refund would mean more to a low-income person than to a prosperous person, but some may disagree with that. That's simply my suggestion. I would simply do it as a straightforward credit on the next income tax filings for total simplicity, ease of administration. But the point is very simple. The state would collect only what it needs to provide essential services and protect itself against the downturn and to have an adequate reserve. Above that, the money stays with the taxpayer to be spent on family needs, to be reinvested in a thriving economy and a growing, the investments that a growing economy needs. I looked at approaches taken in other states. A couple states have done this on a one-off basis. Minnesota a few years ago. In Oklahoma, there's a legal limit on the size of their rainy day funds, and once they had a rebate. But I would make ours automatic. I would make it also, I hope, a permanent feature of life in Indiana. It would not tie the hands, as some other limitation measures have, of future state governments. In any year in which reserves dip below the stated protective level, there'd be no refund. It would only happen in those years in which the state was solvent with a larger than necessary bank account. It's my view, it's my guess anyway, that we would have a new set of incentives for our legislators. Incentives that lead them in the direction of caution in spending public dollars. Knowing that if we could pass budgets that left more than 10% or more than the stated level in reserve, their constituents would all get a tax cut and that they could rightly take credit for. Possibly we could reverse an incentive which too often, certainly in those other states we looked at, leads legislators to want to spend more and more and more, curry public favor by doing so, sometimes to the eventual detriment of the state. there's probably not a lot of money involved. If we'd had a 10% stipulation in law in the earlier years, we'd have had something like $300 a family in 1 year and something less in other years. It's more a matter of principle that it is the money of the hardworking people of Indiana than it is the likely size of the dollars. I will tell you that if it were in law today, the fiscal year 09 that Ryan and I are wrestling with already, very uncertain, perhaps unlikely there'd be such a refund, because it'll be a test all year to make sure we keep spending in line with flat revenues. Still, I think the principle's important. I think the opportunity's important. So the goal here in these two suggestions is to create for our state of Indiana a new position and a deserved reputation as the most taxpayer-friendly, taxpayer-protective state in America, a place where people are not charged unduly to live in the home they saved for or to farm the land that may have been in the family for generations, a place where there is certainty and an upper boundary on what government can take, either for the in the taxation of property or the taxation of hard-earned income. In every measure, as they're piling up now, of attractiveness to new growth, to new investment, to new business and jobs and the people, Indiana is rising and rising fast. We are a top 5, top 10 state, no matter who looks, Forbes magazine, the nation's CEOs, the American Legislative Exchange Council, one after another, is seeing there's something going on in this place called Indiana. I will tell you that last month, in the midst of national stagnation, our Economic Development Corporation had the best month ever in signing new transactions to bring new jobs to this state. The second best month ever in terms of the number of jobs, more than 3,000 that represents. There is momentum, there is energy, and there's an attractiveness about our state now that augurs so well for the future of the young people in this state. Before we know it, Gina and the kids her age will be sitting where you are. And we have a duty and a golden opportunity to leave to them, to the future citizens, business leaders, Rotarians, Hoosiers of all kinds, a world of, and a state of enormous opportunity and prosperity and the higher quality of life that comes with it. And I think these two ideas today that I've laid before you are more building blocks, more long, long steps along that road to fiscal sufficiency, responsibility, and economic hope on which we, I believe, have embarked. Thank you for this opportunity and for the questions I now welcome. If there are any questions I really don't like, there'll be no 50-50 drawing. And yes, ma'am. Well, this has nothing to do with that. These are completely separate subjects. First of all, I said the level of sufficiency is one we ought to talk about ourselves. Maybe it's more than 10%. Please notice the budget of the state could be anywhere that the General Assembly picked. Anywhere. It could spend vastly more than today, if that's what is decided through the process of freedom and democracy. All I'm saying here is that having set that budget level, if there is more in reserve than is really needed to protect, that money ought to be left in the pockets of Hoosiers. Some of them would spend it on piano lessons, I suspect, or the arts. They would give it to the arts, as I do and many people do. I hope they will. It's very important. The arts are an enormously important part of that quality of life I just mentioned. But please understand, this doesn't set any limit on the spending of the state. I might prefer a lower limit than you might or others, but that's a separate discussion. The only question here is, should there be some trigger, some tripwire, some governor on what the governor is in a car, you know, on what is collected at any point in time? And are we not better as a state if any such extra dollars are still in the pockets of taxpayers and not in the pockets of the government, where, as many states have learned, as Indiana did to its detriment, that $2 billion went away very fast because it was committed to spending that proved not to be sustainable. Every time I think about that $2 billion thing, I remember that story, you know, about the apocryphal Hoosier lottery winner and who won a bajillion dollars, and 3 years later he turns up broke, and the media goes to see him and says, "What? How'd that happen?" He says, "Well, I spent the first half on liquor and loose women, and to be perfectly honest, I wasted the rest." Sir? From memory, 2011. You're talking about Edwardsport? I hope that's the first of several. The question is, when will we broke ground a week or two ago on the world's first at-scale coal gasification plant. It's going to be in our state. I hope it's followed quickly by other plants that turn the abundant coal we have in an environmentally friendly way into the energy we must have, into other forms, methane, perhaps liquid fuels. But Indiana intends to be a leader in this respect. And it was very important, I thought, that we established that position. This is a very exciting project. At almost zero emissions, the most harmful emissions, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, mercury, they're all orders of magnitude below the plants of today. Why? Because the coal is turned into gas on the ground. Nothing goes up a stack. And if it's decided that it's important to limit CO2 emissions, this plant is in a position and in a place to bury the CO2 in the ground. So I'm, on top of all the jobs and the fact that we'll produce our own power here and not have to import it from elsewhere, here's a little factoid to take away with you. Today, as Hoosiers, you and we all spend $1 billion a year to buy coal from other states, lower sulfur coal that can be burned at environmentally acceptable levels. How much better if we could pay that $1 billion to Hoosiers and keep it circulating in our economy?
Is there any chance to get a motorcycle assembly plant in the state?
A motorcycle assembly plant? Well, you know, I'd be for it. Let me just say that I think you're going to see that Indiana is a very viable place, even in a weak national economy, for investments of all kinds. And let me just tell you that I just mentioned the number of agreements we came to or came very close to or are about ready to finalize just in the last month of July. I think we're going to break another record this year. I would never have forecast this with the national economy going flat. But I'll tell you, I am such an optimist about Indiana, near and long term. Our location is more important than ever. At an era of $120 oil, it really matters. You cannot be shipping things long distance. And I don't, because energy costs are not going to totally turn around, especially given our national policies, it is going to work more and more in our favor. The electric car is going to get here faster than I thought. And I predict to you, and we are working on this, a lot of those cars, or at least the components for them, will be built in our state. An electric car battery weighs hundreds of pounds. You cannot be shipping it from California, let alone China. So I don't know about motorcycles, although I have my hopes. But you're going to see a lot of manufacturing, as well as all the diverse kinds of jobs which are now coming to Indiana in greater numbers. I'm just convinced of it. And there's no job to which we attach higher priority. Yes, sir. What a great question. You must be in marketing. Anybody hear the question? Gentleman says, hey, in just 4 years, the eyes of the world will be here. Won't be the only time, by the way, but it'll be the Super Bowl will be maybe the most important such time. And what do we hope people will say by then about Indiana? You know, this is exactly, I wasn't thinking Super Bowl, but this is exactly the question I've been asking myself for 5 years now. I've told this story in a speech or two. Within the first few months in this job, I traveled to the East Coast and saw a Fortune 50 CEO about jobs in Indiana. And I knew he was a marketer, had come up that chain. The minute he asked me this question, he said, just as you did, he said, Indiana. I said, well, what are you guys known for? What makes you distinctive? And that's a sensible way to think about things, just as you do in your businesses. What's our, unique selling proposition? What's our distinctive edge on the competition? I said to him, that's a fair question, and today it's not easy to answer, but in a few years it will be. And also I'll give you some answers that I think we're well on the way to. We will be known as the best place in America to do business, at least outside the Sun Belt. We're already about there. We will be known as a leader of the green energy revolution, with not just clean coal, but ethanol. We got the world's biggest biodiesel plant already in our state. And you watch what happens in fields like batteries and electric cars and ethanol from waste and so forth. We will be known as a state of unique innovation in public services that keeps taxes low while delivering essential services as well as they are delivered anywhere, if not better. We will be known as a state which has attacked its infrastructure problems. I could show you a slideshow longer and frankly more stunning than the one I just did about our relative advantage in building roads and rail and forward done, I'm sure, mass transit to move people and goods. Without telling a story I hope you all mainly know, while most of America is, tonight 49 governors, or most of them, will go to bed worried to death that they are the next Minnesota. A year ago this week, a bridge fell down, you all recall. This is more than economics. The Highway Trust Fund, the Federal Highway, that system's broke and broken. It's turning up less money. It was already turning out less money than we needed by untold billions of dollars, and now it's turning out less than before. We are sitting on billions of dollars and reinvesting them in a network that will magnetize, I'm convinced, businesses to come here, knowing that at a time when transportation costs are a bigger factor in the cost of structure of their business than ever, here at the crossroads of America, stuff can get in and stuff can get out quickly. So those are some of the answers I would give you. And, given 4 years from now to then, I bet you we can produce a couple more.